From our headquarters in Oslo, Norway, and on behalf of our host, Robbie Peralta, welcome to the Mnemonic Security Podcast.
Everyone around you at any given time has a motive. And with the right order and combination of words, that motive can be exploited. Now that may have sounded sinister, but we're not the Black Cats. So for this episode, we're going to dive into the things that you can say to your management to get their attention and to get you budget. As management these days face a lot of uncertainty. Internal and external risk coming from all directions. Now we as security deal with the cyber aspects of that risk, but as you can see on the news, there may be a few other things that the suits need to deal with. And to be honest, sometimes cybersecurity isn't the most important thing on their list. Luckily for us, that responsibility is not on our shoulders. As long as we provide them with an accurate, understandable view of how cyber provides risk to their business and its operations, and perhaps also a strategy or two on how to address them, I'd say the rest is on them. And today's guest has written a few books about just that: how to communicate the risk business.
Levi Gunder, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you, Robbie. It's great to be here.
It's been, I don't know, a year, two, perhaps, since I saw you last.
I lose all track of time because of COVID.
Are you still in sunny San Diego?
I am. So I travel a lot, but when I'm home, it's great to be in Southern California.
We could be friends, even though I'm from NorCal.
Two different states.
I'm in Norway now.
As you
know. Yeah, right. So, I want to say hi to you from a mutual friend of ours, Ferry, from ING. Or you probably know him from the Dutch National Police or the cyber, forgot what they call it over there. But
yeah, that's amazing. I've known him probably close to 20 years just through you know, law enforcement and various private sector engagements. Great guy, really knows his stuff. Always fun talking shop.
Yeah, so Ferry is a new colleague of mine in Mnemonic, and he knows you because you were in the Secret Service when you guys knew each other, I guess.
That's right. That's right. A lot of great guys and gals, for that matter, in the agency and doing cybercrime work in the early days. And a lot of those people had moved on to the private sector just because the opportunity cost is so high, right? But I was very fortunate and blessed to meet very early on in my career, and you know, now being able to stay in touch with a lot of those people is really great.
You've been in TI pretty much your whole life, right? So I think it said FBI on your LinkedIn, but Secret Service, FBI, Cisco Talos, Fidelity, and you're now the CSO of Recorded Future. So that means you also have physical security as well?
Yeah, that's right. So information and physical security, and I get to help out with INSIC groups still, which is great, as well as fraud.
You have a lot of war stories, basically.
Yeah, there's some good stories over the years, but it's all good stuff. All a lot of fun for sure.
Yeah, and you've also written a book. He showed me the book that you sent him, The Risk Business.
Yes, that's right. So it's interesting. I actually wrote the first one pre-COVID, and so much of it was focused on quantifying risk. And there's a lot of people in our industry who have to deal with this concept of, you know, how do you sort of calculate risk and communicate it, right, to other executives in the board. If you can put it in dollar terms, it's helpful because it's more specific and people understand, oh, like this is going to cost us money and this is how much money. But the problem is that unless you're in the insurance industry where there's a lot of actuaries that already do that sort of thing, generally speaking, the board doesn't really want to get into figures and equations on how you came up with those figures. Shockingly, they still prefer to talk about risk in a qualitative way. And so this is sort of the second iteration of the book is more about storytelling, right, at the board level. And there's so many great people that work in information security, but the biggest problem we have as an industry is it's very difficult to bridge the gap between security and the business and the enterprise, where they understand risk sort of holistically in a lot of different categories. But when it comes to cyber risk, there's been this historical challenge to communicate and storytell in a way that resonates with the board. And so this book, the second iteration, is really about, if you want to quantify risk, like, more power to you. I still think it's a better way to communicate risk. But at the end of the day, it turns out, after talking to hundreds of CISOs and literally every industry vertical on earth, that there's not a lot of appetite for that at the board level. They're still sort of wanting to, they want to talk about risk in story terms. And it's still a little bit, you know, of the likelihood and impact, which are very imprecise in my opinion. So I talked a little bit about why words matter, right, greatly. And we can probably use better words in our storytelling. But at the end of the day, it's really some thoughts on how to categorize, how to move from intelligence to risk in a programmatic way, and how to help your teams think a little bit bigger, right, about how they connect with the business, which is so important.
Mm. And he mentioned that he had taken some of your words and operationalized them. So he had made, like, risk categories. I think you also just said the same thing, like pillars, right? Like, you have your reputation, that's a pillar. Then you have, like, your operations, like downtime, that's another one. And
yeah, it turns out all cyber events fall into one of five risk impact categories. And this is for the private sector. It's not for the public sector, right? If you get into intelligence within the military or law enforcement, it's a different story. But in the private sector, it's really five risk impacts. So you have brand impairment, right? It's a long tail, sort of difficult to measure that sometimes. You have operational disruption, obviously very important with ransomware. You have a legal or compliance failure, which I would say is probably the most relevant and impactful, regardless of industry, as a motivator. You have competitive disadvantage, right? Which is, A, there's someone in our network and they're stealing intellectual property or information that can be used to, you know, hurt us in the future competitively. And then the fifth category is financial fraud. And that's really, obviously, these days, you know, you see a lot of that business email compromise. There's a ton of attacks that are, you know, improving. The efficacy of attacks are improving because of generative AI, and a lot of that leads to financial fraud. But all cyber events, regardless of what they are, lead to one of those five risk impacts. And I think it's been really helpful for our clients as well. When you sort of talk about, well, what are the intelligence requirements? If you sort of understand the risk impacts that are most relevant to business first, then it really helps you frame and contextualize what you're doing in your intelligence program, what you're doing in your security program, because not all risk impacts are equal. Generally speaking, most businesses care about one or two, sometimes three risk impacts, and less about the others. And so, for example, you know, you're in financial services, you care deeply about a legal or compliance failure, right? You have to pass your audits. Like, that's a given. So there's a lot of things that flow out of that, right? When you understand that that's your number one risk impact that you need to solve for. And then you can sort of map into what are all the various scenarios, right, on the cyber side that trigger that particular risk impact and that ultimately cause loss.
Shouldn't this be, like, very much ingrained into everybody that has, like, security in their title almost, you know? Like,
yes,
this is, like, this
I couldn't agree more. It's hard, right? It really is hard, I think, for sometimes to up-level at the business, to the business. And I think when you understand the risk impacts, it's just a lot easier to sort of think through how you're going to prioritize your resources, right, as a security team. And I think that's really helpful. So I'm super passionate about evangelizing the ideas. And, you know, it's not a big book. It's a quick read. You can probably read it in a couple hours. But I really am passionate about the ideas. And I think that they will help you if you're responsible for any part of a security program. And even if you're just a practitioner in the trenches, hands on keyboard, I think it also helps you to better understand, like, this is how we're going to connect to the business. This is how we're going to tell our story.
Yeah, and that's one thing that's one thing that security is failing at, is connecting to the business, right? And this is, like, a very, very simple, easy way to do that. So that was our first lesson learned. So thank you for that. And thank you to Ferry for enlightening me of that book. Nice. But what I wanted to talk to you today, a couple things. The reason I sent you a message, I'm not sure what I was doing when I sent you that message, but, you know, everybody and their mothers using ChatGPT and Bard these days, right? And I remember the client. The client is very, like, complex. They do a bunch of different stuff. Oh, they're all over the place, right? So they bought a tool, and then they were like, okay, too much information in the tool. We try another tool. too much information in the other tool, the contact mnemonic, can't you just read all these tools and figure out what we need to know and help us to like communicate that to the business? Yeah, okay. So we do that. And then, you know, that goes back and forth. And at the end of the day, then the business was just like, they're not even reading it, you know? So then that all just gets thrown to the side. And now I had this conversation with that same exact client a few weeks ago, because we're talking about, you know, these language models. If you had a chatbot and on top of Recorded Future or Dragos, would that would kind of eliminate the need for a mnemonic, as long as you have an analyst that knows what they're doing on the side of the chatbot, right? Is that something that you talk to your clients about? Do you have a chatbot as a part of your product these days?
We do. So we were actually one of the first to integrate GPT into Recorded Future into the platform. So the first evolution of that was, you know, we have intelligence cards in the platform that's really a summarization of a lot of information. And GPT did just beautiful summaries of massive amounts of information. And the great thing about it was, you know, we were including traceability into the results. And so when you pull up an intelligence card, whether it be on, you know, an actor or a TTP or, you know, some geopolitical situation, you know, you get this AI produced summary that had footnotes, and each of the footnotes sort of gave you where it originated from, which was just super helpful. And then we just launched 2 months ago, basically the chatbot that you're referring to, which is the second evolution, which is the, you know, the back and forth dialogue, obviously based on the corpus of knowledge inside of Recorded Future. And I think, you know, it's obviously a work in progress, and I don't think it's ever done, but I think it has been helpful for our clients because, you know, it saves analysts in particular just a lot of time. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And I don't think you're necessarily going to replace humans, to your point, but I do think it becomes an absolute necessity. Like, it's not a nice to have. It's an absolute requirement now.
Just because the sheer amounts of information that are in your platform, or have you heard any feedback from your customers about it?
So I haven't heard. I mean, I have not directly heard from our clients. I know other folks at Recorded Future have, and there's been a lot of positive feedback on it, both the first iteration and the second iteration. I think, you know, there's still a little bit of trying to figure out, you know, as various companies and various industries trying to figure out, you know, what can we use, what can we not use, what is okay for input, you know, on the privacy concerns. There's obviously a little bit of trying to figure out the mechanisms and, you know, is there a DLP component to this to make sure that we're not giving proprietary information to, you know, an AI that could leak it somewhere else. And so I think there's still a little bit of caution out there, but I think it's sort of like cloud computing, right? Over a decade ago, where people were like, you know, we can't move our data to the cloud, right? And now it's ridiculous to do anything but move your data to the cloud, right? For all kinds of reasons. I think, you know, we're going to run through some of that same evolution with generative AI and the LLMs. But yeah, I think the early signals are very positive.
Yeah, because I could see it being like, if I was, you know, working in a company, if I was one of those individuals that had my 5 risk categories mapped out, then I would really easily be able to use that chatbot and that platform to be like, okay, how does what's going on in the world apply to my, you know, and go back and forth. And that would be accomplished in a much quicker way than it would be to go through some analyst in a company that needs to read through all the data and at human speed, I guess.
Yeah, cool. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think a lot of, you know, we have some brilliant people in Gothenburg, where one of our offices is, you know, that work on the AI piece. But then we also have a risk team inside of Instant Group, and they're just trying to keep up, you know, with the latest developments in terms of, you know, what is available, what are the capabilities, and a lot of what we spend our time on, we sort of call it the so what, the now what, the then what, right? Which is, all these events happen on a daily basis, but, you know, what is the applicability to the business? What is the applicability to an organization or an industry in terms of second order implications and really second order non-obvious implications? And I think right now, like if you work with GPT-4, it will give you implications. Like it'll do a great job of summarizing implications from a geopolitical event, from a cyber event. but it's not really going to give you the non-obvious just yet, right? In future iterations, it may. But I think to your point, it's sort of, it's going to help you ideate and maybe give you 60, 70% of what you're looking for on the second order implications, which is like, what does this mean for our business? And what are we not seeing? What are we not thinking about in terms of second or third order implications? So it's not necessarily going to give them to you, but it is absolutely going to help you in the process of thinking through, you know, those elements.
Can you give me an example of a second, third order implication?
Yeah, absolutely. So the one I talk about all the time, I think it was about 18 months ago now, Recorded Futures Insight Group put out some really good reporting on how Chinese threat actors had embedded shadow pad implants inside of India's power grid. And this was basically right after a physical escalation that happened in the Himalayas, you know, right on the China-India border. And right after that happened, we started to observe these shadow pad implants. It started in the north of India, but basically by the time they were done, they had infiltrated, you know, most of India's power grid, and these substations that we were able to locate, the actual physical substations that they had implanted into, probably for just pre-positioning, right? And so we saw that traffic between implant and controllers. And so you look at that as a Western business, right? Let's say in, you know, North America, you look at it and you say, wow, okay, well, there's all kinds of interesting sort of technical details in the reporting here. You can see, you know, how the implant works. We can see the communication. We can see, you know, obviously that, you know, China has a real interest in the pre-positioning here. But again, we're not in the public sector, right? We're not in the military. We're not in a police organization. We work for an enterprise, right? So why does the enterprise care about what's going on in India? Well, you say a second order implication is, do we outsource IT call centers in India? Do we have developers that work in India? Do we have any sort of vendor supply relationships that come out of India, right? And if the answer to any of that's yes, then the follow-on questions have to be, you know, do we understand the impact if China decides to turn out the lights in India? And this was 2 years ago, right? I'm not saying present tense, but 2 years ago, when you're analyzing this, do we understand the impact, right, to our business, our organization, if we have vendors and suppliers that we rely on who no longer have power in India? Do they have backup generators? Have we diversified some of our risk geographically, right? Should we think about having additional capabilities in other parts of the world? Have we done a tabletop exercise? I understand this, right? There's all sorts of very hard, crunchy takeaways that you call, that's a second order implication for the enterprise, right? I would give you another one. Like we recently have seen Russia compromising various telecommunication networks and embassies around the world, mainly in Europe and the Middle East at the moment. And again, right, you look at it as a sort of, you know, pure analyst that comes out of the public sector, you go, oh, it's very interesting. Like we can look at the, you know, TTPs that Russia is using. We can, you know, analyze all of the technical details. It's very interesting and relevant for our defenses, of course, right? But there's also this other point of if your business, or if your enterprise is engaged in doing business in those parts of the world, or you're trying to expand into those parts of the world, and China does this in Africa, actually, you have to be very careful about emailing embassies, right? Anything regarding your business plans, anything regarding, future work or expansion or anything that you're doing sort of in coordination with a foreign embassy, you have to sort of understand that those communications are probably being intercepted. And there's a foreign government who's now aware and maybe positioning themselves to compete against you. And you may have no idea about that as a business, right? So that's sort of what we say is a second order implication. And if you can get to a non-obvious second order implication, it's extremely valuable.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, those examples used, there's probably somebody in the business that would have thought about, you know, oh yeah, like if it has to do with India, they would have immediately thought, oh, that's important for us. But the security team would not have necessarily thought about that.
Right.
Interesting. By the way, How does Recorded Future get all this intelligence? How do you know, how would you know that things are going down in India's power grid or that Russia's infiltrating these embassies, you know?
So we collect a lot of different types of data, everything from, you know, non-structured data in, you know, criminal forms to, you know, open sources like, you know, code repositories and Telegram channels and so forth. And then on the technical structured data side, we collect a lot of different types of data. It's a lot of tree, you know, everything from passive DNS to malware metadata. We actually acquired a company that does sandboxing, and there's other types of technical telemetry that we collect that, you know, help us with that visibility, and we put it all together. So it's not, I won't get too into the weeds, but those are sort of the high level categories or buckets of data that we collect and process.
Yeah, because usually like that sort of information comes available from like a sock vendor or something. You know, Mandiant comes, the Indian power plant calls Mandiant and says, hey, come tell us what happened. And then, but that you're actually doing this collection on your own through your own means and putting it together. I guess that's the secret sauce of what you do, I guess.
Yeah, and you're right. To your point, you know, we don't do IR. We don't do incident response. We're not on site and we're not an EDR vendor. But we do have midpoint telemetry and we do have a lot of visibility from different technical data sets. And, you know, the way that we put those together and the analytics that we create are pretty impressive. And I'm still sort of blown away by it, to be honest with you, because I think we've created something pretty special.
One day I hope I'm a client so I get to sit in that sales meeting and get the juicy details. But one thing I want to ask while you're here is like, I'm sure you've noticed there's a lot of companies saying they're doing darknet monitoring, right? There's like, I was at a FS-ISAC event, FS-ISAC summit in Europe, and there was literally like 8 different intelligence companies there talking about like how they, you know, yeah, it's all, we have the best analyst and, you know, they speak Russian. And I'm kind of thinking like, how many, you know, are there really like dark nets out there where the bad guys are actually planning things anymore? Because there's so many companies that have like infiltrated them. Can you just give me like a status of like where that space is? How much of the companies are bullshit out there, you know? How's this actually working?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a really good question because, you know, I was doing this in English criminal communities, you know, 20 years ago at Secret Service. And obviously, you know, there's been a lot of evolutions in terms of the way that threat actors communicate, you know, from IRC and peer forums to, you know, larger migrations to Telegram, right? And different mechanisms for communication. But at the end of the day, you're right. You know, there's a component of anonymity that, you know, threat actors obviously use, but then, you know, law enforcement and private sector uses as well. And, you know, I think you look at organizations over the years, you know, Intel 471, right, who do this very well in terms of just the human sources. And it's hard to know because, you know, at the end of the day, there are a lot of threat actors still making money, you know, selling unauthorized access. There's a lot of threat actors that still make real money on, you know, selling malware and malicious code. You know, the info stealer market is super hot right now. You know, there's subsidiaries, there's affiliates, there's these entire ecosystems of threat actors that are involved in these ecosystems. And I think to some degree, there's an awareness that, quote, good guys are infiltrating the community. And that's just kind of the cost of doing business, right? And I think for a lot of them, depending on the country they reside in, they don't worry about it a lot because they're not, you know, they're either not worried about extradition, they're never going to leave that country. You know, there's a lot of ways that threat actors probably dismiss the infiltration component of it. But I agree with you as well that they probably are not as open in their communications anymore with each other because they've read too many indictments, right? Particularly out of the U.S. They just read too many indictments and they understand, you know, how it all works. And they know, right, that once law enforcement is able to get to one member of their community, that means the entire community is now compromised and they're never going to know, right? So I think they're smart enough and they're aware enough to understand that. But But I think the economic opportunity is too great to turn down. It's actually interesting. You know, we have a lot of data from InfoStealer malware, you know, which is how a lot of organizations are compromised these days. You know, if you look at some of the big headlines of late, you know, like in Las Vegas, you know, where ransomware groups have been successful, a lot of that starts with stolen credentials, right? And those credentials oftentimes come from these info-stealing malware families like Redline, Avadar, and so forth. But it's really interesting because bad actors also infect themselves either, you know, knowingly or unknowingly with the same info-stealer malware. And so we actually see them sometimes logging into known malicious resources, right? And it's interesting because the volume is really incredible. Like there are thousands and thousands of authentication events to criminal forms, to you know, other types of tools and resources that threat actors use, and it's sort of spread throughout the world, right? I mean, you literally, I think I ran the analytics the other night. It was like over 160 countries, like IP addresses from over 160 countries that were logging into malicious resources, right? That were captured by info-stealing malware. It was super, super sort of ironic at the moment, but it just gives you a taste of the volume, right, of threat actors. And so I'm sort of giving you a very long-winded answer to your question, but I think the bottom line is the economy for criminal goods and services isn't going anywhere. And at the same time, they understand that there's risk in the communities.
Mm. Is it because they're so distributed, like the, you know, you have initial access brokers, like the community is so dispersed and there's so many different small groups that you kind of have to have it open to make the system work? So that's, you just, it's a cost of doing business, like you said, like it's just an acceptable risk.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, if you're a higher tier threat actor, meaning, you know, you're established and you sort of have a Rolodex of actors that you work with that buy your criminal goods and services, then you probably interact less because you start to move to the side of the spectrum that's more about managing risk, right, of attribution. But if you're not well known and you're just starting out, then you can't afford to not be in those communities, right? And you have to build your Rolodex. So it's kind of, where do you fall as a threat actor on that spectrum? But I would say the older actors that have been around, you know, that have great goods and services, they're able to interact less, I would say.
Right. Yeah. Because they have the pondus of their status. I read something today by Rick Ferguson. He said that ransomware is dead. Everything is going to, you catch his drift. Do you agree? Ransomware is dead. They're just going to steal your information. And if it's not encrypted, you're fucked, basically.
Yeah. I mean, I I know. So very, very,
I summed maybe it up a little bit, but yeah.
I'd say it's a little bit reductionist, but I agree with where the sentiment's going there, which is obviously organizations are catching on, right? They're investing heavily in resilience. They're, you know, and maybe not like city, municipal governments, but in the private sector, I think it's safe to say at the enterprise level, there's been a huge resource investment in resilience. So if they are hit with ransomware, they understand exactly how long it will take them to restore from backup, right? They understand whether they're going to negotiate with the actor or not. They've done tabletop exercises. They brought in external parties. You know, they studied it five ways to Sunday. And I think that's true. And so I think a lot of what we've seen over the last year, maybe 18 months, is that more of these ransomware groups are moving away from that pure, we're going to encrypt your data, to now, of course, we're going to steal your data and we're going to use the threat of a legal or compliance failure to get you to pay up, right? And so you come back to the five risk impacts. Again, legal or compliance failure is the one that has a lot of teeth. And when you think about punitive fines, you know, whether it's GDPR, whether it's through, you know, the FTC or the SEC in the U.S., you know, looking at some of the evolving legislation in the EU, NIS2, DORA. What's interesting is all of a sudden these ransomware actors have become legal scholars and they understand the regulatory regimes that these enterprises are operating in. And they are, you know, of course, there was this big story a week or two ago about how, you know, a ransomware group reported a victim to the SEC proactively, which is just sort of, I mean, you have to chuckle a little bit, just the absurdity of it. But at the same time, it's a real thing, right?
Makes sense.
Legitimate thing. Yeah. So I think what he's saying is, you know, ransomware in terms of the primary objective is changing, right? And they understand the regulatory regimes, especially around data privacy, are only going to be increasing and evolving across different geographies. And once they understand what regulatory regime you operate in, they're absolutely going to go after you. And I think, you know, for a lot of our clients, and talking to them about this, I was actually talking to a COO in the UK last week about this. And we had a great conversation. And you know, we were talking about, okay, you know, here's the threat. What kind of risk does it actually represent to the organization based on the controls they already have in place? And, you know, we were talking about the fact that, you know, all of their data is not encrypted, right? And then you talk about, well, what kind of encryption, right? Is application level encryption? Is it disk encryption? And then, you know, it becomes a broader scoped project, right? Of course, around data classification, which is, do we actually understand all the data in our environment first? And then, you know, once we've done that successfully, then we can sort of figure out what absolutely needs to be encrypted, right? At rest on disk, whether it's, you know, PII, PHI, whatever, you know, category or label you want to put on it. But it becomes, those projects absolutely take on new urgency in the way that, you know, ransomware tabletop exercises were happening a year ago. It's now the data classification and encryption questions.
Interesting. Yeah, I think his point, and I apologize, Rick, if you're listening to this, I didn't mean to misuse your words, but I think his point, it was like encrypt, right? Like he asked a question like,
yeah,
if your data gets stolen, but it's encrypted, do you get a fine? Like,
right. Right.
I think the answer is no. I'm not really sure. But interesting.
Well, interesting question. You could ask a ransomware actor. I'm sure they have a cogent response for you. Yes.
Right. Exactly. Since they're legal scholars. Do you have any closing thoughts? Anything that you are going to use a little bit of your time on moving forward that you find interesting, especially interesting?
That's a tough question. There's so much that's interesting. I mean, obviously, we talked about AI. I think, you know, generative AI and LLM is just fascinating right now. I was actually speaking to a group of CISOs on this topic, and I do think there's a lot of challenges with it in terms of, you know, do your defenders have the same capabilities, right? Are they able to access the same resources as adversaries start to use generative AI across text and images and voice and video and code? Are your defenders using the same capabilities? Right? Or do they have access to the same capabilities? Are they able to model offensive scenarios? So watching the development there, I think, you know, it's a daily thing now. You know, when you think about how do you retrain users, right? I mean, everyone does security training on phishing, for example, but how do you go back and redo training, right, for your organization that, you know, the quality and velocity of social engineering, your phishing, your smishing, is so much better, right? How do you help your organization and people in the organization to better understand what's possible? Right. And then, you know, do you sort of just assume breach? Do you just sort of assume that there will always be humans that are the weak point and you're going to invest more in detection and remediation? Right. You get a group of CISOs together. There's obviously startups in the space, right, that are trying to come up with solutions for, you know, identifying deepfakes and so forth. But it's a big problem. Like, it's a big, big, challenging problem. And I think it will continue to be for a while. So that's a really interesting space. And then, I think the other interesting space is just third and fourth party risk. Right? When you talk about legal compliance failures, again, third and fourth party risk, it's very difficult for organizations to get their hands around the complexity of it. And that's another one. Like, there's no silver bullets. They're very challenging problems. So that's kind of the space that I've been thinking about and focused on. But there's plenty of fun, plenty of challenges.
Right. Yeah.
What about you? What are you working on?
Same old, trying to help clients convince their management and their boards that a security is worth investing in. At least that part of the equation has gotten easier, right? I really like your five risk categories, pillars. That's going to be something I tell to everybody along
Thank
with your
you.
Book.
Thank you.
So that part of the job's gone easier, but it's,
But how do you, I'm curious about that. Like when you talk to them, like where is the point of diminishing returns, right? Like where is the point at which they feel confident in the level of investment because they don't, you know, and you can't take risk to zero, of course. Like where, how do you help instill confidence in them that, you know, they're investing correctly and timing their investments correctly to match, you know, their risk appetite?
You know what? I feel like this very much, depending on the client, depending on the personality of the person you're talking to. Some of the, like the more senior ones are just like, hey, at the end of the day, this is not my risk. It's my responsibility to communicate the risk, but it's their responsibility to accept it and do something with it. But whereas the younger ones, they're all like, just like really stressed all the time. And because they're, nobody knows if they're right or wrong, right? If you're talking to Demonic and buying something, if we do our job, nothing happens. But nothing happening, I'm not sure if that's a good thing or if it's a bad thing for them. So it's like, it depends on the personality. It depends on like the sort of standing they have internally. It's always interesting. It's just a bunch of politics. I feel like it's, at the end of the day, it's literally internal politics. But it's really nice to have, when your colleagues come to you and say, hey, was this a good investment? And you could actually say, well, it made sense at the time because this is what we're dealing with. And like, I think you said at the beginning of this conversation, it's the understanding of risk at the end of the day. And if it's a conversation, the stories that you're able to tell, if that story works and they can relate to it, then it works. Then you did your job for that part.
Right.
Yeah, quantifying risk. I don't think anybody, I've never met one on this side of the world that actually went down the route like quantifying risk. Really difficult.
It's interesting because, you know, I think you still talk to CISOs, you know, who run into sort of a brick wall when they're trying to create that coalition, you know, where they need more resources. And there's still a lot of that sentiment of, well, it hasn't happened to us yet. And then once it happens, then all of a sudden the floodgates open and it's, you know, like checkbook. But it's obviously this interesting paradigm that the security industry has been dealing with for a long time. It's nothing new, but it's still, you know, for a lot of companies, it's still, you know, sort of at the executive board level. There's a divorce from reality, right? Until that event happens, like you said, and the absence of an event is intangible. But, you know, as soon as there's a ransomware attack that's successful, then, you know, the entire paradigm changes. But why couldn't it be a proactive solution?
Yeah. And I also feel like just the way that people are compensated, like the board members and you know, senior leadership, they're not going to be there for more than 4 or 5 years anyway. If they're younger, you know, if they're like really successful, if they're like a money hungry CEO, like they don't care. They're not incentivized to care about security. So there should be somebody else in there that actually does care. And that's just simply not in place.
Yeah, that's a great point, actually, because obviously the incentives are on profit margins. Like that's a great point, right? And before they move on. It was interesting to your point that we were talking about CISOs at our conference, Predict, 2 weeks ago in London. We were talking about, you know, the SEC's action on, you know, individual solar winds, right? And how it sort of created ripple effects in the CISO community. And, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who used to be at a financial services company in Singapore, senior guy. He was saying, in Singapore, you're personally liable on the book, right? If there's a breach and, you know, you're deemed to have, you know, been insufficient in some capability or capacity, like you're on the hook to the point, you know, you could go to jail for a couple of years and you're not allowed to have personal liability insurance. And so it's interesting because, what you're saying in terms of, you know, people, the executives at the top, there's that dynamic in terms of their incentives. And then you have the CISO incentives, and CISOs are typically, their tenure is like 18 months to 36 months. Right. And their incentive levels are also a little bit different. But when you throw in sort of the personal liability component to all this, it's like CISOs are vastly underpaid, number one. You know, and number two, the requirements to take the role for a senior enterprise in the future is probably going to change.
Mm. But something's got to happen because it's, but then again, after, you know, I've been doing this for so many years, the amount of companies that just get off the hook for, I'm not sure if it's lucky or, you know, a lot of companies, they don't invest and nothing happens. So I guess they won, you know, in that sense, we're good for them. But then you have those that didn't, and it doesn't. So it's, But yeah, a lot of politics. That's what I'm. What I meet very often. It's helping somebody make a good story that somebody else on the other side will nod their head to and be able to sign off on.
Winning hearts.
I'm not
and
sure
minds.
If that's exactly. Mr. Gunder, thank you for your time. I appreciate it. Sorry about the camera, but I don't think you care about that. You look great either way.
This mug was made for radio, Robbie. I appreciate the time, man. It was great catching up.
A radio face. I like the shoes in the background. Cool. Hi from Ferry, and we wish you happy holidays.
Likewise. Talk to you soon.
Thank you. Ciao.